from Birmingham, and he's an undergraduate at Imperial College in London. Very international. He's had stints in research in Ireland, Austria, and Italy. Very varied career. Actually was involved in the first ever teleportation experiment back in the late 90s in Italy, in 97. Even actually has a paradox named after him in the field of teleportation, the Hardy's paradox. So something that, one of the things that he's most well known for. And incredibly well regarded around the world in foundations, done a lot of seminar work. Increasingly over the last kind of couple of years has become interested in to connect with what Sean talked about, what quantum gravity might have to say about the interpretations and what quantum physics really means. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand over to Lucian, and you can see the title up there, Interpreting Quantum Theory.
So originally I arrived in the wrong place, and I was giving my lecture anyway, even though there was no one there.
It's nice to have a full lecture in to talk to. So I want to, this talk can be very casual, so if I'm just going over stuff that you know already, please ask questions, divert me, and we'll go as far afield as you like. Have you done this? No. So... This is a nice puzzle. I've been thinking about things you can tell students, and this is a nice puzzle that you can tell high school students. It's called the Elitzer-Weidman bomb puzzle. This is Avi Elitzer and Lev Weidman, two Israeli scientists. They propose this puzzle. So imagine you have a factory that makes bombs. And the bombs they have a handle, and they also have a trigger. And the trigger is so sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever hits the trigger, then the bomb will explode. But there's a problem, which is that the manufacturing process in this factory is a little bit imperfect, actually quite imperfect, so that sometimes the trigger is there, but sometimes the trigger is just missing. And so we call the ones with the bomb with the trigger good bombs for no good reason, and the ones without the trigger bad bombs. Okay, so that's morally dubious, I understand. The puzzle is it ever possible to know that we have a good bomb without exploding it? Now, it's okay if in the process of getting a good bomb, we explode some bombs. But we want to, it's a bit like the problem of matches, you know, is it possible to know that a match works without striking it? Is it ever possible to know that we have a bomb that would explode if a particle was to hit it without actually exploding it? And it sounds like that's impossible, because the only way you could see if the trigger is present is by shining some light on it, or some other kind of particle, and that would cause the bomb to explode. So you'd know that you did have a good bomb, but it's now too late. The bomb has exploded. Okay. So that's a nice puzzle that you can give to students. So I just want to go over interference. I think this is probably increasingly familiar to you over the course of the last few days, especially from what Damien has been telling me. But let me just recap anyway. In the first example, we just imagine a gun, or it could be, you know, in the film it was a tennis ball, a machine that fires tennis balls, and they're being fired onto a screen. And we have here a detector which detects when the tennis balls, whether the tennis balls hit here. And we have three situations. The first situation where we have slit two closed, slit one open, and the distribution we get is like this. This is a probability distribution. The second case where slit one is closed, slit two is open, we get this. And then in the third case, when they're both open, we just get the sum of these two probabilities, which is like this. Okay, that's more familiar. The second case is where you have a classical wave source like water, and again the double slits, And you may have a detector here which detects, you know, how high the wave is. And then this is the intensity or the height of the wave. If you have one slit open, you get this path. If you have the other slit open, you get this path. If you have both slits open, where you get wave interference, it's something that's perfectly well understood, and you get this variation in the intensity. And then the surprising thing is the quantum case. You have now electrons, for example, it doesn't have to be electrons, it could be atoms or photons or some other kind of particle, and they're being fired through these double slits. If you have slit one open and two closed, you get this. Actually, you will get some diffraction interference in the far field, so you will get some slight fluctuations, but that's not really very useful pedagogically, so often it's ignored. Same is true here. So, of course, if you have slit one closed and two open, then you'll get this pattern. And if you have both of them, open, then you'll get this pattern. Actually, so this whoever generated this graph did a good job, because you can see that the height here is actually four times as big as the height here, not twice. Which kind of compensates for the fact that here it's zero. If you take the sum of these two, then you'll get a graph that passes through this. The reason you get four times rather than just twice is because in quantum theory you add together amplitudes and then you square. So you're sort of doing, it's one plus one, then you take the square, which is four. And here's some data from an actual experiment. So this is where you send the electrons through one at a time, and this is where you've just had eight. On this screen you can't even see them, but there are eight dots somewhere in there. There's one. In here there's 270. Here 2,000. And here 60,000, and you start to see the very clear bands appearing. Okay, so that's interference. So it seemed to me that the video itself really did a good job of making it clear why this is mysterious. But if you have a smart student, I think it's good to be able to really explain why this is mysterious. So I want to show you carefully why the simple wave picture fails, and also why the simple particle picture fails. It's kind of obvious why the wave picture fails. Let's just go through it. So imagine we have this experiment. Imagine we have many detectors. These things really just measure the height of the wave. When I say fails, I mean why it fails for the electron gun case. So why it fails for this last case. So these detectors, so what we notice in the electron gun case is that you only ever get one scintillation on the screen at a time. Or in other words, only one of these detectors could ever fire at any given time. So you send one electron through, one detector will fire. And this doesn't make sense from a wave point of view, because if you have a wave go through, well then the wave is all the way along here. So it's possible for the wave to cause many of these detectors to fire. We'll see some intensity in all these different places. Einstein, there's an even simpler example. So Einstein in 1927 at the Solvay conference. Solvay conference in Belgium. He considered a very simple situation. You just have a diaphragm with a single hole in it, and then it's got a hemispherical screen around here. And you send an electron in, and the electron hits here, and it spreads out like a hemispherical wave. And then just before hitting the screen, you've got this wave that's spread out all the way around here. And then what happens is, you just get the electrons detected in one place on the screen. not two, not five, just one. Okay. And Einstein called it a peculiar, he called it a spooky action at a distance. You know, how does the screen here know not to fire? There's a wave just about to impinge on it, and then suddenly this bit of screen fires, so the wave over here doesn't fall to detection. How's that possible? Spooky action at a distance. It's interesting, actually, for those of you who've read a bit into quantum foundations, this example here already contains the seeds of the later famous EPR, Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, that came along in 1935. Okay, this already contains the essential paradox. So the wave picture doesn't work. Because according to the wave picture, you should get, if these detectors were set so that they would only detect if the intensity of the wave was above a certain level, then several of them should fire, because the wave intensity will be above a certain level in many different places. So that fails. Why does the particle only picture fail? So this is more interesting. So imagine you have a smart student who says, "Well, I'm going to insist on trying to find some way of modeling this where I have a particle that goes from the source through one of the slits and then hits the screen." Okay, why does that fail? Here's the problem. The particle goes through here. Consider the possibility it hits the screen here in just such a place that you have destructive interference, fault struck interference. Then you can say, if slit two is closed, if this slit is closed, then it is possible, actually, for the particle to go along here and arrive at this detector because the probability on this curve is non-zero. On the other hand, if slit two is open, then the probability here is zero, and then it's not possible for the particle to take the red path. But how does the particle know, if it goes along path one, what is happening at slit two? It's like if you drive to school every day, you drive and you always choose one of two routes, and one day you happen to choose route one, and unbeknownst to you, there's a roadblock in route two, but that doesn't affect your behavior when you get to work, it's as if the roadblock wasn't there. That's the classical situation, but in the quantum case, that sort of thing fails. Okay? So you can't have a particle-only picture. It doesn't matter how clever you are with this particle bouncing around doing crazy things. If this particle goes along this path and doesn't know anything about this path, I put the word "know" in inverted commas, of course, then there's no way to explain the data. So it seems that something, I should put inverted commas on this as well, has to go through both slits in each case. Every time you send an electron from here, something has to go through both slits. So in quantum theory, we have the quantum state. It's given by a wave function, because it's kind of like a wave. It's actually complex valued. So this is, any particular x and t, this is a complex number. But for the most part, you can think about that when you're teaching, when you're telling students about the mysteries of quantum theory. It is interesting why it's complex. People have many different opinions. I have an opinion, which I can tell you about later. And then what happens is this evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. So the Schrodinger equation is a particular equation. You'll find that most people in this building have forgotten what it is. I'm one of them, which is why I didn't write it down. I can never remember whether there's a plus or minus at a crucial place in the equation. But it doesn't matter. The point is, this is an equation that evolves the state. And it evolves it like a wave, so it keeps a wave until it turns a wave into a wave. So imagine you have a wave. You have a little bit of this wave function at time t0. and then it emits and it kind of spreads out just like a wave does, continues to spread out just like a wave does. Well, here, most of the wave gets absorbed by this this backdrop, but a little bit of it will go through each of the slits, and then it will continue to evolve, and then just like waves do, it will interfere. And then just before you get to the screen, you have all this interference. And then a funny thing happens. Rather than looking at the intensity of the wave, like you do in usual wave theory, water waves or other kinds of classical waves, you use the wave to calculate the probability. You take the square of the amplitude of this wave, and that tells you what the probability is of seeing the particle at any particular position along the screen. And you only see it in one place. You don't see the particle in two places. Okay, and this explains mathematically why you have all these curves. You know, so if you have one slit open, well, this wave would spread out and you'll have no interference. If you have the other slit open, then the same sort of thing, you'll get this pattern. But if they're both open, you'll get interference. But it's kind of problematic. Let's just think about it a little bit. Consider what happens just after the wave has passed through the double slits. So here you have a little bit of wave here coming through there for that psi 1, and a little bit of wave here coming through here for that psi 2. And so the state is really just the sum of these two little bits of wave. And that's called a superposition. And it's sort of like saying you're superimposing two different stories. One story where the particle goes this way, two different classical stories, another story where the particle goes this way. So you can say that the state of the stage is something like the particle passes through slit 1 and the particle passes through slit 2. Both terms in this state seem to be necessary. It's not just the probability distribution, as we discussed before. It's not just saying, well, there's a 50-50 chance the particle is here or here, and these are the terms in the probability distribution. Both these terms are necessary, and in some sense necessary each time an electron passes through. Are there any questions?
I think this is all,
please. You've been doing this all in terms of electrons, particles having some weird wave functionality.
Yeah.
But how does it work if you do it the other way around, say something we are confident is a wave,
right.
Light,
yeah.
Goes through the same thing, mm-hmm. and we seem to be more comfortable with light being an electromagnetic wave
right.
that can pass the two slits and the electromagnetic mm-hmm. waves will interfere.
Yeah.
Then the weird thing is
the
photon.
Yeah.
Why do we only detect the light at
yeah.
one particular place on the screen?
Yeah, so, and I suppose it's a question of what you're used to. I mean, if you have a sufficiently dim source of light, then the particle behavior is very clear. You'll see the particles arrive at one at a time. So it's very analogous to the electron. But at this level of, at this level of discussion, the mathematics is pretty much the same. And I think the concepts are the same. It's just a question of where you're coming from, what it is you're used to.
What's the weird thing?
I think the weird thing really is both of them. That you have this wave behavior and this particle behavior. The fact that you have, in either case, that if you were to put a detector here and a detector here, only one of those two detectors would fire, whether it's a photon or an electron, only one would fire, and yet you still need to have some term in the mathematics corresponding to this place and this place. That's the weird thing. It's the kind of the combination. But yeah, it's a good question.
Because, you know, I'm interested in the statement there that both terms seem to be real. Is that related to simply mathematically, if you should take the square of a complex number and therefore it's a perpetual thing? Or are you therefore suggesting that this is a real physical wave
that's passing through? I think the second thing, I mean, of course, the first thing is true, you need it in the mathematics. But this argument I gave you, this argument fails. And this seems to be an attempt to say, well, there's only something, in each case, you can consider there being something here and nothing there. Okay, that argument fails. It's impossible to describe what happens. Each time you do it, you have something here and nothing here. So that's what I mean.
I think you said, question there about the electron and the photon. You said it's essentially the same thing, or is it the same?
I would say it's the same thing. So at this level, if you're just considering sending a single particle through the double slits each time, whether it's an electron or a photon, the mathematics is completely the same. It's the same thing, and I think, from my point of view, and that may be because I've been thinking about this, from my point of view, the mystery is the same in each case. Photons and electrons do start to behave differently when you look at more than one of them. Their sort of collective behavior is different. And here we're just looking at one at a time, so that the mathematics, and I think the mystery is the same. Perhaps the surprise factor is different because you have different expectations.
What do you mean by the collective behavior is different? Because the interference pattern you get, if you send lots of photons, mm-hmm. is the same as if you send one over a long, one and
yeah, so that's true. So in these kinds of interference experiments, you send lots of particles at once. The behavior is the same. But you can do different kinds of experiments where you're somehow getting the particles to interact with each other directly. And then the behavior is different. So this is not so interesting from an interpretational point of view, but it's interesting mathematically. So if you send two photons onto a beam splitter like this, well, actually, if you send two electrons like this, so here's an electron, and here's another electron,
and they're coming exactly, they have exactly the same momentum, they arrive at a beam splitter, which causes them to get split evenly, then actually what will happen is only one electron, you have one electron from each side. And the reason for that is that electrons are fermions and they can't occupy the same state. So they have to come out one on each side of the beam splitter. What's strange is if you send photons, so this is a photon, you can use a photon. And again, the two photons are in exactly the same state and they arrive at a beam splitter. What's peculiar is actually in this case, both photons will come out the same place. So as you have two photons here and no photons there, or vice versa, you'll have two photons here and zero photons there. So that's an example where photons and electrons start to differ, that collective behavior is different. And ultimately that's connected up with the fact that macroscopically, when you have many of them, photons behave like waves and electrons behave like particles, you have different intuitions. But at this level, because we're only talking about single photons or single electrons at a time, none of this is relevant. And so the mystery is the same.
Whether they're fermions or bosons.
Yes.
Not whether they have rest mass or something.
I mean, that's going to make a difference as well. But I think, so far as the quantum theory is concerned, maybe it's whether they're fermions or bosons.
So how does that diagram conserve momentum?
That's a good question. I think what happens is this beam splitter is actually will be, to make experiment work properly, the beam splitter has to have itself some momentum uncertainty.
Okay.
And so because there's uncertainty in the momentum, so if this beam splitter was in the exact momentum state itself, then it wouldn't work this way, because you could look at the beam splitter and see which way the two photons have gone. But the beam splitter will be in an uncertainty. So the impact due to the photons will just be quite small compared to the full uncertainty of the momentum in the beam splitter. And so that's how it's going to fall. So at the level of the photons, the momentum is not conserved. But overall, it would be
good. Okay. So let me continue. So it seems we need both of these two terms. Something seems to be passing through both slits. But then there's a big problem. Where does it stop? Well, so I just gave you an example of, you know, where you have an electron at position one, electron position two, electron near slit one, electron near slit two. But the mathematics is the same for atoms, and quantum theory is not afraid to give you a superposition of atoms in two places. They're same for molecules, same for cells, same for cats, same for humans, some big jumps in scale, same for galaxies, same for the whole universe. There's nothing to stop. If you have this mathematics, then actually it's sort of inevitable that you will get superpositions just like this of all these different objects. Actually, in the case of the universe, it's a bit more subtle because you can't really tell the difference between the universe being here and the universe being here. But definitely, you know, whether the configuration of the galaxies is one thing in the universe or another thing in the universe is something that you can have a superposition. So Schrodinger equation is just going to do that, relentless. Nothing can stop it. It just keeps, it's unitary evolution, it's called. It just keeps including more and more things. So the classic example, which I'm sure you've come across, is Schrodinger's cat. I was searching on the web for a picture illustrating a different version of this. There's a version due to John Bell, who's very famous in the field for his work on locality. And he had a version where the cat was, rather than being alive or dead, it was either hungry or not hungry. So what would happen is that it was instead of breaking a vat of poison, it would give the cat some food. But anyway, this is the usual version. You have a radioactive source, so it's a quantum source, which may or may not decay during some time period, say half an hour. If it decays, it may activate this lever, which causes a vial of poison to be smashed, which then kills the cat. So after and imagine that there's 50-50 chance of this happening. So after half an hour, the cat was either alive or dead. But it's not that it's either alive or dead in quantum theory, because this is all quantum. The cat is alive and dead. You have this same thing. You have these two terms. In principle, you could do an experiment analogous to the interference experiment. In practice, it would be very difficult. But in principle, you could do an experiment where it mattered that you have these two terms. Practically, you can't do it. In principle, you could imagine doing it. So this brings us to the big problem in quantum theory. So this problem, if you talk to anybody who works in the foundations of quantum theory, the problem is called the measurement problem. But there's a better name for the problem due to Philip Pearl. And he calls it the reality problem. And this is the problem. So in the example of the cat, the quantum state has both cat alive and cat dead, but this isn't what we see. When we look, we see the cat alive or the cat dead. So there's a discrepancy between the quantum description of what is happening and reality as we see it. That's a pretty serious discrepancy. In the classical case, you don't have this discrepancy. So for example, the classical state for particles is given by specifying the position and the velocity of each of the particles. And if you look at a bunch of particles, that's what you see. There's a match between the classical state as given in the theory and reality as you see it. That's not the case here. And this is such a serious problem in physics that most people ignore it. A small number of people take it seriously. Any questions on that? Okay. So what this means is that we need an interpretation of quantum theory to try and make sense of this, to try and solve the reality problem. And broadly speaking, there are two types of interpretation. So there are the realist interpretations, and these are where people make an honest attempt to describe some kind of underlying reality which gives a consistent picture. And then there are the instrumentalist interpretations, where you keep the description of reality at the level of the instruments, of the apparatuses, and you don't try to explain what's happening in the underlying reality. So why realism? Why do some people want to have a realist interpretation of quantum theory? So it seems that So one could have two different opinions on what the purpose of physics is. So one opinion you could have is that the purpose of physics enables to do calculations to get to predict what's going to happen in experiments and to get those calculations right, so we can make airplanes fly and so on. And that's important. And of course, if your theory doesn't make correct predictions, then it's no good as a theory. But another idea of what the purpose of a physical theory is that it should describe what reality is like. So a physical theory tells you the way the world is. And realists take this seriously. So they want to actually understand the way the world is. Of course, there wasn't a problem with classical physics because we had no reality problem, but there is a problem here. An instrumentalist just wants to keep the description of reality at the level of instruments. And there are various good reasons for doing that, which I'll talk about later.
Hardy, because I tend to get caught up in semantics and vocabulary. Is instrumentalist the same thing as positivist?
I think there's a whole continuum of different schools which are related to, once you depart from realism. One could say that instrumentalism was a slightly less radical version of positivism, where you believe in the reality of the instruments. I mean, there are extreme versions of positivism which lead you to solipsism, where you just believe in what you see yourself. And then there's instrumentalism, which I think is less radical, where you believe in the reality of the instruments. Like if you pick up a particle detector, you believe that's real. You might not believe that electrons are it. So there's a whole continuum there, and you'll find this is a messy area, and I think you could tell I was kind of hesitant
to
get into that. I actually think it's important, but it's messy.
So the realist interpretations. There's three main realist interpretations, which I think you've come across, but we'll go through them. I think the best way to summarize them is on this table here. So we have two choices. Either we introduce collapse by modifying Schrodinger's equation, and or we add something to the state description. So I'll explain what I mean by this. So here we have the table, and here we have the various possibilities. So we can have collapse, and we don't add anything to the state. So this is where we say, well, the wave function is the full description of reality, but we allow collapse, and we have things called collapse models. Over here, we don't have any collapse, but we do add something, and what we add is actually particles with positions. And here we have the pilot wave model. And over here, we have where we don't add anything and we don't have any collapse. And here we have the many worlds.
Of course, there's a cross here because you're sort of solving the same problem twice here. So there aren't any major interpretations here. A few people have tried to work out theories in this box. If you're interested in that, ask me about it. There's no major attempt at interpreting quantum theory in this box.
In the Copenhagen interpretation, which one is
that? So previously I gave you this divide, realist and instrumentalist. So I think Copenhagen is over here, but I'll talk about it. It's kind of a mess.
She's seen a
mechanism yesterday. Yeah. I heard about it.
I wish it was filmed. So. Oh, the... They'd be on YouTube before the day's over. So any more questions on this?
Okay. So I'm going to go through each of the three boxes. So this, both this one, then this one, then this one. So the collapse model. So here's the idea.
You take Schrodinger's equation, which I've not written down, and you modify it. You actually just add a term in the models I've looked at. And you add a term which is such that for small things like electrons, this term hardly affects them at all. So the electron will just behave like a wave or pass through. You'll have interference and everything. But big things like cats and detectors will collapse very rapidly according to this modified Schrodinger equation. And actually, the way this works in the model is that you have a very small probability of collapse for each small particle, say for each electron. You have a very small probability of collapse. But if you have many particles, then although the probability of any one of them collapsing is small, the likelihood is very high that you'll see collapse from one of them. So here's an analogy. Imagine you have one person who's trying to sneak through a room, either taking, you know, through a dark room without waking up the baby. You know, so and either you go one way or another way. But you might sneeze. Well, if it's just one person and they're sneaking one way or another way and trying not to wake the baby, then there's a small probability they'll sneeze and probably the baby won't wake up, you know. So the baby will stay sleeping. On the other hand, if you have a billion people trying to sneak through the room, then and they're all either going one way or another way, deeper in, then there's a very high probability that one of them will sneak. And this will reveal the location of all the people, because everyone is either going one way or another way. And in quantum, in the classic kind of situations we're considering, you typically have, for example, a detector or a pointer that should be in one position or another. And so all the electrons in this pointer are either here or here. So if one of them collapses, then it will collapse to one position or another position, and thus reveal the position of the pointer. So that's sort of how the mathematics in this works, and that's how it accomplishes. That either collapses, that for small things you have a very small probability of collapse, but for big things you have a high probability of collapse. So in this example, what happens is here you just have one electron, very, very small probability of collapse. In the models, the collapse only happens once every million years for a single electron. But then suddenly you arrive at this screen here, and the electron causes excitations, possible excitations in the electrons in this big screen. And now you have lots of electrons being involved, actually many, many, many billions, you know, roughly 10 to the power 27. And so it's very likely that you'll get collapse. And then the collapse will be such that you'll in fact just see one of these slight effects of power for the whole way from the collapse to one position. So I've given you a very wordy description of what is some more delicate mathematics. So I'm not sure I've completely described this, but I'm just trying to give you an idea.
I've got two words that seem to be describing similar things. There's collapse and there's decoherence. Are they two words of the same thing, or are they...
So you'll have people...
People have screaming matches about this in conditions of quantum theory. So I'm on the side of people who scream that they're different. So decoherence, what happens is, decoherence is, in quantum theory, is a mathematical procedure where you say, I'm going to ignore a certain part of my system. So typically you ignore what you call the environment. You know, it's the bit of the system you're not looking at. So then what you do is mathematically, you have a procedure for ignoring that. And then the effect of that mathematical procedure is to cause the wave function to effectively collapse on one of many things. But it's a mathematical procedure. But it hasn't actually happened. I mean, reality doesn't care about what you choose to call the environment and what you choose to call your system. Whereas these collapse models are not just mathematics, this collapse actually happens, not because you trace over an environment, but it actually happens in the mathematics. So the wave function actually will collapse to one of these terms. So there's a big difference. If you ask somebody else, might be able to do it.
The two-slit experiment has actually been done with molecules, like buckyballs.
Yeah.
They are made of many particles.
Yeah.
Do we actually notice any effect that the wave function tends to collapse more quickly?
So they have, well, 60 atoms, I guess, which is still quite small from this point of view. I mean, with those experiments, if you look at the interference curves, you're actually not seeing much interference. The interference is, the visibility on these curves is much smaller. So this doesn't come down to zero. even here, where you have distorted interference, you still have quite a lot of detections. So, and the explanation for that traditionally would just be that the experiments are imperfect, and they weren't able to get exact interference. But what that does is that it would hide any effect like this. So any effect that's due to some fundamental change in the Schrodinger equation would be hidden in the mess of those experiments.
Okay. So there's some experimental evidence, but it's hard to interpret.
I would say there are experiments which aren't up to the purpose of distinguishing this. There are other situations. So people have spent a lot of time looking at these models and considering various experiments and seeing if you can at least shove the parameters into a particular place where they become unreasonable. I'm not completely up to date on the status of that attempt. There's a lot of experimental data out there. So one thing, for example, that these models do, if you take just an individual atom, say a hydrogen atom, and you have the electron in the ground state, and then you hit it with one of these collapses, it will cause the electron very occasionally to be excited. Okay, and the probability of that happening is very small. But if you have many atoms, then you may see it. And so if you have a big vat of hydrogen atoms, then you would expect to see some protons being emitted just because of this process. So people have tried to put limits on the parameters in these models in the process. And my understanding is that the situation is that that these models are still feasible, although they have been limited by the experimental data. Any more questions on the class?
Your analogy of this sticky test, you may sneeze or not, reminded me of the Tübingen experiment where the electrons are passing over plate where the electrons that are near the plate can stimulate a current that can be detected, and the ones that are farther away couldn't. And so there's a continuous change from an interference pattern down to a no interference pattern.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess that would be probably. So this kind of thing often looks the same as decoherence,
mm-hmm.
And I think the example you're talking about. The example you're talking about would be explained with decoherence. But yeah, it's the same kind of basic idea. Yeah. Okay. So the pilot wave model. I spent some time in my youth being an advocate of the pilot wave model. And even though I'm no longer an advocate of the pilot wave model, I still get annoyed when people criticize it. And actually, the video which I liked, the only part of the video that we saw yesterday I didn't like was where Sean was saying, and somehow, Mark Foster knows which way to go. So, actually, there's an equation that tells you exactly that. Here it is. Okay, so now I can calm down.
So the idea is in the pilot wave model, you have both a particle and a wave, which seems, and here I'm going back to my youth, such an obvious idea. It's crazy that people don't think about it more. I mean, rather than saying wave-particle duality, we could just say, well, we have waves and particles. And I think it is a great idea, and it works. That's the great thing. And not only does it work, but it's by studying this kind of model that you see all sorts of features of quantum theory that I think have had a massive impact on the field of quantum theory. Just as an aside, there's something called Bell's theorem, which proves that quantum theory is non-local in a particular way, which I'm not sure we'll have time to cover that. Well, John Bell was motivated by looking at Bohm's 1952 papers, because this Bohm model has the feature of being non-local. So it's a beautiful model, and what you can do is look at it and see, well, is that some generic feature of any, is that something that happens generally in quantum theory, in quantum interpretations, or is it just particular to this model? Okay, so here's how the model works. Associated with an electron, you'll have both a particle, which has a definite position, and a wave. The wave will go through both slits, and the particle goes through only one slit. So here's an actual calculation that was done. Here you have the two slits. You can imagine, so the wave will go through the two slits and interfere. You've seen the sort of way that waves look as they go through two slits. The particle will go through just one slit. So this shows many particle trajectories, but consider just one of them. So imagine the particle goes through this slit and is on this trajectory, then the particle will follow this path here. We'll have all these wiggles in it. Hello. Oh, is that what it is? Right. Right. Yeah. So anyway, the way the particles wiggle, as you can see, and they wiggle in just such a way that they tend to collect in bands. If you consider many cases, so this is where you consider them many times over, and so you'll get the interference pattern. And so this is a perfectly natural explanation. It shows particles passing through double slits and arriving and producing interference. It solves the measurement problem because the particle position, or in the case of a bigger object, of course you have many particles in a cat, but all the particles will go, for example in the cat, all the particles will go into the dead or alive position. And the particles are guided, by the way, through this equation. This equation, well-defined equation. Any questions on that?
Why does that affect us when we
I think there's no simple relationship. These trajectories are not really the same trajectories that you see in Feynman path method. What Feynman does is he considers any path between here and the screen, and has an amplitude associated with it, and then to get the total amplitude for a particle starting at this position and ending up in that position, you consider all the possible paths that start here and end here, and add the amplitudes together. So it's a sort of mathematical technique that's equivalent to usual quantum theory, but it doesn't carry with it an interpretation. Whereas here there is an interpretation. The interpretation is that there is actually a particle passing from here to here along one of these trajectories.
To why you don't like it anymore?
So Einstein called it cheap. And I think I know what it meant. It feels like it's not quite deep enough to really address the issues. What I would like to see is this picture emerging emerging from some deeper set of postulates. So if you could actually derive this from some deep set of natural postulates, rather than just put it on top of the present formulation of quantum theory, then I think it would be a lot more believable. I think it may contain in it some essential ingredients that will play a role in the final interpretation.
Skipped yesterday on this one. it had a similarity to the statement about relativity, that mass tells space-time how to bend, mm-hmm. and space-time tells mass how to move.
Okay.
And this seems to have a similar thing. The pilot wave mm-hmm. Is determined by Schrodinger equation, mm-hmm. and the pilot wave tells particles how to move.
Yeah, although it's interesting because the model is often criticized for not having back reaction. So it's true that the Schrodinger equation tells the waves how to move, and the waves tell the particle how to move, but the particles don't tell, don't inform the wave or the Schrodinger equation. So normally in physics, you have back reaction. There's a reaction back. And one of the criticisms is that the wave just continues oblivious to what the particles are doing. And it's actually a serious criticism. One of the reasons I feel uncomfortable with this. So at this stage, imagine you have a wave here and a wave here. And the wave continues here. And these waves interfere. Over here you have some bit of wave which isn't telling this particle what to do. And when you have many particles, you'll have waves associated with many, many particles, which are not telling, where there's no, so you have a big piece of wave that has many degrees of freedom in it, which could be associated with many particles, but which have no particles in them, which are kind of empty, and therefore don't correspond to reality, you don't see them. So what am I trying to say? They're a bit like zombies. So they're bits of the wave, but because they don't have particles in them, are not manifest in what we see, and yet they're still real, because the wave is still some real thing. And so the universe is populated by these kind of zombie waves.
Well, I tell my students that all the time.
Right.
There's a gravitational field right there,
yeah.
and it's not causing anything to fall right now. But if I put something there, then it would fall, and that's what a gravitational field is.
This is sort of worse, though, because there's a certain point where you no longer have the ability to put anything there. So, for example, with the cat, let's show the picture, you'll have some bits of the wave associated with the cat being alive and some bits with being dead. So imagine all the particles end up in the alive part of the cat. So they're not just then the part of the wave associated with the dead part of the cat is massively complicated. Has all the structure of a cat being dead, and yet it's very unlikely. And yet it would be essentially impossible to ever make that do any work for you. Not impossible in principle, but impossible in practice. Maybe it's the same thing. Maybe it's the same thing, but it seems to me a lot more. It seems to me to be a lot more unsettling that you have these waves that have all the structure for the things they could represent, but don't actually represent that. If you yourself end up in a quantum superposition. And then you go along one path, not the other. Then you'll be a wave that's evolving, just as you would have evolved, doing all the kinds of things you would have done. But you're not there, you're in the other one. So it really is a zombie.
Well, then that's okay. Because the only place that I'm being attracted to the Earth right now is right here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a zillion other places around the Earth where I could be, but I'm not.
Yeah.
And I would have been attracted towards the center of the Earth if I had been there.
Yeah.
The gravitational field is still there.
Yeah.
But it's not doing anything to me.
You're right. It's exactly the same thing. It's just there's a degree of complexity that follows me. You're right. And what the point you're making is exactly the point I've heard advocates like Shelley Goldstein and others there's lots of debates in this field. Yeah.
I just want to add a bizarre twist to this. I have two ways of getting to work.
Say what, sorry?
I have two ways of getting to work.
Yeah.
But out of habit, I always take one way. And one day, I'm just trying to make up a little story. And one day I thought, well, gee, I have another way going to work, so I choose that.
Mm-hmm.
But out of habit or superstition or whatever, I still choose to go that way to work. And I kind of see it in that light here.
Right, but this kind of... This
so I have a mental state, and that mental state might be quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is me going from here to work.
Yeah. I think you're right. There's at least an analogy that somehow you could sort of dream of the whole scenario where you go to the work every way, but that reality doesn't actually manifest itself.
Show you my state of mind, but I can actually show the results of that output. I can't show you my thought process.
Right.
I'm going to go the way I've always gone, right?
Right.
But today I made a choice, deliberate choice, to go the way I always wanted to because of habit, superstition, or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I kind of see it in terms of this also.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, one of the criticisms of this approach is that this is just the many worlds interpretation in denial. So this would say, well, you have this way, it's real. Anything that's real in the world is real. So it must be, in some sense, so there really is a person. This isn't a zombie on the other side, it's a real thing. And it's really just the many worlds interpretation. Okay. So many worlds interpretation.
Which I should tell you up front that I think this is crazy. What's amazing, actually, is that it's becoming increasingly popular in physics. A lot of people working in cosmology, for example, working in quantum information, believe in the many worlds interpretation because it makes a lot of sense in those contexts. I just find it too crazy. Maybe I'm too old. I don't know. So the idea is that reality is described by the wave function alone, full stop. And so that's the interpretation, that's it. Okay. But then you have to make sense of it. And to make sense of it, you can start to tell a story where the world splits every time you may see more than one possibility. So the idea of the interpretation is, this is it, nothing else. But now we're trying to tell a story to make sense of it. So imagine, for example, you have a cat that's alive or dead, and you look, and you see the cat. So what will happen then is you'll have two terms. You have a cat alive and you see cat alive, or cat dead and you see cat dead. And you'll have a superposition of these two things. And the story you can tell is that, well, this is as if the world is split into two copies, one in which you see the cat alive and another in which you see the cat dead. And this will just continue every time you see something.
In many worlds rather than many universes?
No. Yeah, I don't know the history of that. I've always been curious as to why so many worlds or many universes.
But does it describe actually the idea that the universe is splitting?
Yeah, I would say it's the idea that the universe could be regarded as splitting. You'll notice something cagey about the use of this word splitting. It's really, you take this as the reality and then you try to interpret it. And you interpret it in terms of splitting. It's a bit like when you have a map describing reality and you draw grid lines on the map. The grid lines are kind of a useful way of describing what's going on. And I think splitting is a useful way of thinking about this from a sort of internal point of view, but it's not. The splitting isn't in the wave function, it's just in the way you think about it. Universe, sometimes people call them parallel universes. So that's it, and it's kind of crazy. It has the great benefit that it is very simple to state. It just takes the wave function as it is and take that as the object. And the people who defend it say, well, it's, we have to make these changes, just like we have to stop thinking of the planet being the center of the cosmos. We have to stop thinking of the planet being the center of the cosmos and think of the sun being at the center. We have to make this move. Well, this is a theoretical object we have. We have to take it seriously, and so we have to take this point of view. there are some serious problems with Merivale's interpretation. So for those of you that don't like it and are looking at, and are looking for a way out, there are broadly speaking two serious problems. One of which probably has been solved. So the first problem is, well, for this thing to work, you have to account for appearances. And you have to say, why is it that we see decoherence? Why is it that we see the cat being alive and the cat being dead in a particular basis? Another mathematical possibility is that we see this, we just see this superposition. So there's a lot of technical debate there, and it seems to have been solved using decoherence. The other problem is the problem of probability. So you use quantum theory to calculate probabilities. And the probability, you know, for example, the probability that you see an electron here, that's the probability that you actually see an electron here, or an electron here. So something kind of happens. And the probability could be 50% here, 50% here, or 25% here, and 75% here. The Merivale's interpretation has to kind of explain that, but there's a problem because there aren't any probabilities. Everything happens. Yeah. So if everything happens, how do you get probabilities? You know, if you, every time you throw a dice, every time you throw a die, I should say, you see every outcome, then there's no sense in which saying, there's no sense in saying that one has a probability of 1/6, because you saw all of them. So there's a big problem in bridging that gap between the understanding of probability as being the probability that something happens and a situation where everything happens. And certain people claim to have solved that problem, a whole bunch of people working in Oxford, in the philosophy department, who claim to have solved that problem, but the controversy is still there. It's not clear whether they have or not.
Sorry, you're suggesting that many worlds, people are saying that all states are possible with equal probability.
No. So they say when you have this, this is the state of the world. So there's no probability because everything happens. For probability to happen, you need, to talk about probability, you need one thing to happen and not the other. So what they do is they try to still account for the fact that we can use probabilities in our daily life. You know, we use probabilities in making bets, and so on. So they try to account for the behavior of agents in this kind of universe being consistent with the way we use probabilities. So they get into some quite sophisticated game theory. And there's a lot of debate about whether they've succeeded or not.
Wouldn't the other world have some very improbable events happening all the time?
Sorry, say it again.
The other world that's created and lots of very, very improbable events happening all the time.
Yeah.
The point will always land on the edge.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is weird is that those worlds where the most incredibly improbable things happen have as much reality. I mean, they are real in this interpretation.
Yeah.
And they absolutely happen. If something unusual happens in your life, you don't feel like you're less real as a consequence. You feel just as real. Surprised, perhaps, but just as real. Yeah, exactly. People debate exactly the questions.
That's a question I'm always had. If all these universes are peeling off constantly from each other, what happens to the law of conservation of energy? Does each universe get its duplicate set of energy?
So, I mean, first of all, there's no reason you have to be in a law of conservation of energy. Actually, the collapse really told you about that. That doesn't obey conservation of energy. You'll produce particles out of nothing. So it's really an empirical question. I think the law of conservation of energy would be satisfied so far as any observers were concerned within one branch. They would see it satisfied. And whether it's satisfied across the universe is kind of a matter of interpretation. Do you regard each of the, if you have splitting, do you regard each of the new universes as being half as real as the original one? So therefore the weighting in the conservation is only half or what? It doesn't really matter because you would never make that measurement. you know, so, yeah, that, I guess that's the best answer I can give.
Where are they?
Where they were.
So, the universes.
So, if you ask someone like David Deutsch, he would say that if we were to build a quantum computer, then we would actually sort of see them because they would be doing the calculation for us. Because the way the quantum computer works is you sort of take advantage of this, of having a superposition of many, many different possibilities, and you kind of do the calculation. You kind of do all calculations at once. But then you make some effective measurement on them because you can't see more, so you have to do something better. So some people would claim that if you build a quantum computer, then you're seeing them.
So there's one thing
I've noticed about many Walton computation is the discussion can always expand to fill whatever space. So instrumentalism and operationalism. So I want to be brief here because it's kind of a messy area. So instrumentalism, I think you can see it either as a methodology or as a philosophy. So as a methodology, it's just a technique where you try to refer all your experiments, all your description of experiments to the actual experiment itself. So in special relativity, Einstein was very careful to refer all his measurements, to refer all his concepts to actual measurements he made. And so he was able to see that the notion of simultaneity, absolute simultaneity, didn't make sense through that methodology. So I think as a methodology, I think it's a very good way of doing physics. You can also think of it as a kind of fundamental philosophy, where you say there's no reality beyond the instruments themselves. And then I think you may get into trouble in the long run, because what are those instruments made out of? Where do the instruments finish? And there's all sorts of questions you can ask. And then it's also sort of unsatisfying if your theories are just telling you about detectors and lasers, not telling you about some underlying reality. And then there's this thing called the Copenhagen interpretation. And I think it's reasonable to say that there are at least as many versions of the Copenhagen interpretation as there are people prepared to tell you what it is. And it's very difficult to extract from the writings of Bohr exactly what it was about. I think it had a lot to do with being instrumental, about referring your concepts to actual experiments. There's also this notion of complementarity. So that one experimental situation, the best concept to describe it may be a wave. In another experimental situation, the best concept to describe what's going on may be to use the particle concept. But it's kind of a mess, and I don't really feel I could tell you very much about it. So I'll leave it there. We're getting past time. There's a few more issues in quantum theory. Non-locality, I haven't touched on. I think that's really interesting. So if you get a chance, that's something that's worth reading about. Quantum gravity is also interesting. So my opinion is that I don't really believe any of the interpretations of quantum theory as they stand, but I think quantum gravity is going to have a big impact on this field. And I think once we have a theory of quantum gravity, then it will become clearer how we should interpret quantum. Once we have a theory of quantum gravity, it will become clearer how we should interpret quantum theory. But that's more of a hope. I'm not sure that will work out. I also think instrumentalism is a very powerful methodology. And it's in my own work, I use it very much as a way of thinking. But ultimately, we want to be able to describe reality, so ultimately we need to solve these interpretive problems of quantum theory, in my opinion, from a realistic point of view. And finally, just in case you haven't worked it out, this is how to solve the bomb problem. So what you do is you place the bomb using the handle in just such a position that the trigger, if it's present, is obscuring one of the two slits. Okay. And now you place a detector here. if the trigger is missing, then you'll have destructive interference here. And so it's impossible for the particle to be detected there. If the trigger is present, then, well, a few things can happen. One thing that can happen is the bomb will explode. That's okay, you just try again. Another thing that can happen is that the particle is actually detected here. And you can see there's an amplitude. Of course, it could be detected in other places as well, but there's some problems that will be detected here. And so you know, if this trigger fires, that the bomb has a trigger. I find that example kind of mind-blowing. How do you know that something is present without, you know, touching it? I think it's a beautiful example. And really simple. And incidentally, so this just the description I give you here, you know, this isn't going to be very successful very often, you know, because there's only a small probability. But you can increase the probability by this technique, so 50%. So that you learn, you explode 50% of the bombs and you discover 50% of the bombs of the big bombs, just by being clever. And you can actually increase it by being really clever to just under 100%. There's a very clever technique using what's called the quantum Zeno effect. So you can actually detect, in most cases, whether the bomb has a trigger without exploding it. So I'll leave it to that.
We knew ahead of time we were going to be running a little bit late, so we wanted to take the review 15 minutes late. Are there, maybe we have time for maybe one or two questions. As long as you have time.
I got it.
Anybody have any more questions? Barry?
I was just wondering if it's possible to hang up just a few to just briefly explain or comment on the results.
All right.
Yeah, so
I mean, there's been experiments actually over the years on the paradox. It seemed to have hit the media this time, but not in previous years. I mean, in one sense, it's nice because, you know, you see it actually working. It's not at all surprising because this is, you're doing experiments in a domain where quantum theory is really expected to succeed. But it's interesting to really see that you get these anomalous effects I would have to tell people what the paradox is about to make it sound interesting, but it's nice to see that.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of time to the newsletter, though, the Perimeter newsletter had a pretty write-up.
All right, yeah, sure. Yeah,
there's a write-up in there.
I'll see if I can dig it out.
Thank you. What's the probability that the bomb has a trigger?
Oh, that depends on the manufacturing process. In the story, I think you should say 50-50. It was actually this bomb idea that motivated the paradox. So if you make the bomb quantum, then you're just one step away from getting that paradox. There's a website called Perso.
Yeah. This whole talk is on the website.
Which has all the talks and seminars.
PI
and presumably business.
Yeah.
Here's a little thank you. Oh, Mr. Hardy.